The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here to talk to you about the topic of nuclear power, and it's a real pleasure to be here at the Free Library, and I want to thank Andy for having me. This is a really a great forum, and it's really an honor and a privilege to be able to be here and talk to all of you tonight. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, but I'm going to start maybe in a place you don't necessarily expect. And I have a few slides, and I have to admit I have a few graphs and charts. I'm a scientist, trained as a scientist, so I can't give a talk without at least a few charts. But hopefully they'll be illustrative and not bore you too much. The topic of nuclear power, I think, is a very interesting topic, and it's one that's relevant today for another reason. And that reason really has to do with climate change. As you see, I have a slide up here showing a really dramatic image. This is an image taken of the Camp Fire, which was the deadliest and costliest wildfire that's ever happened in the state of California. You see a firefighter here looking at this incredible blaze, and it caused tremendous destruction, including destroying one town completely. I've seen destruction like this when I dealt with the Fukushima nuclear accident. But the reason I wanted to start with this particular slide and this particular image is to reinforce why I think we're talking about nuclear power today. You see, the reason for this kind of a wildfire, and this is a headline you see at the top of this slide, that climate change is fueling wildfires nationwide, a new report warns. That's a headline from a New York Times story written in November of last year. The reason we're seeing these kinds of wildfires and many other kinds of changes to the environment is because of climate change. So the way we generate electricity, the way we generate energy, is producing pollutants that are going up into the atmosphere and changing the climate. Well, many people think that the solution to this problem is through nuclear power. Here's a quote from Bill Gates, who I'm sure many of you know, as the founder of Microsoft, a very prominent company. And he said, just last year, actually at the end of last year, nuclear is ideal for dealing with climate change because it's the only carbon-free, scalable energy source that's available 24 hours a day. The problems with today's reactors, such as the risk of accidents, can be solved through technology. So it's one very, very powerful statement about the only way, really, that we can deal with climate change, and that's through nuclear power. Another very prominent individual, a person by the name of James Hansen, and for those of you who don't know him, he is really the individual who almost 30 years ago, he was a scientist working at NASA, testified in front of Congress, and really alerted the world the very first time about the dangers and the risks of climate change. Well, in 2005, he started talking prominently about nuclear power, and this is what he said. Nuclear will make the difference between the world missing crucial climate targets or achieving them. James Hansen, 2015. So here you have two very prominent people, one an incredibly accomplished business person, another an incredibly accomplished scientist, telling the world that the solution to climate change is through nuclear power. And when I think about the worries of climate change and when I think about the worries of nuclear power, I become even more worried. Because from what I've seen and what I've learned, I don't think nuclear power can solve this problem. And in fact, I think nuclear power is the worst solution to this problem. So tonight, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my experiences and why I believe that, and why I think it's important for people to understand how nuclear power works, how the industry works. Because if we're going to deal with an even greater problem, which is climate change, we have to go about doing it in the right way. So, for most of the rest of the time, I won't have any new slides. So, what is it that I know that I think these other people don't know? Well, I spent a good part of my career dealing with the nuclear power industry, dealing with it as one of the chief regulators or the chief regulator for a long period of time in the federal government as the chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And understanding how regulation works is not a simple thing. Learning the ins and outs of this very bureaucratic process can be challenging and difficult, and I spent a lot of time doing that and understanding it and learning it, and wrote about it in a book that hopefully you find interesting. So how I got to that, well, I thought I would start by reading from a little bit of the book just to give you a sense of how I came to this particular position. And this is from the prologue. I never planned to be in a position to tell this story. A trained physicist, a Birkenstock-wearing PhD, still amazed that a few simple equations could explain something as extraordinary as the Northern Lights. I never intended to be a nuclear regulator. Before I came to Washington, I had never heard of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There are no television shows or movies with dashing federal agents rushing into nuclear power plants with blue blazers flashing NRC logos. Like you see, you think of the FBI and you see all these things, all these TV shows. But because of a powerful politician and a right place at the right time kind of timing, I became not only a nuclear regulator, but ultimately the head of the agency. This is how my first conversation with Harry Reid, the second most powerful Democrat in the Senate, who eventually got me on the commission, went back in 2001, when I was interviewing for a job in his office. As we sat down in his office, he said in a soft, raspy voice, "I'd like you to come work for me." "Great," I replied. "You're a physicist, right?" "Yes." "Tell me the name of your PhD dissertation." And I said proudly, "An effective theory of mesons, of baryons and mesons." And in very typical Senator Reid fashion, he stood up and abruptly and asked, pointing at the window, "What do you think of my view?" So as I started down the path that would eventually get me the job of commissioner, landing me inside the secret corridors of the agency charged with regulating the nuclear industry, I felt like Dorothy invited behind the curtain at Oz. Then in another unlikely development for a guy with, at that time, untested political skills and his basic idealism still intact, I ultimately became the agency's chairman. So when I started at the NRC, I gave no thought to the question of whether nuclear power could be contained. By the end, I no longer had that luxury. I know nuclear power is a failed technology, and this is the story of how I came to this belief. So I won't tell you the whole story tonight, but I'll certainly give you glimpses and pieces of how I came to that view. So how did I get to Washington, D.C.? Well, as I said already, I started out as a PhD student in physics, learning all about physics and particle physics and nature at a very fundamental level, learning very esoteric things about very esoteric kinds of particles and things in nature. And in fact, I was a type of physicist called a particle physicist. But when I came to Washington, one of the first things that I had to do was find a place to work. And the place I started was working with a congressman from Massachusetts named Ed Markey. And he taught me many, many different things about what it was like to work in Washington. The first thing he taught me, though, of course, was how you pronounced words in Massachusetts. So I learned that he came from a town that was spelled P-E-A-B-O-D-Y, or represented a town, so it was spelled that way. And on the first few days in the job, I got a call from a constituent, and they were telling me where they were from, and I said, "Well, where is that you're saying? Are you from Peabody?" And then Congressman Mark quickly corrected me and said, "No, it's pronounced Pibody." So I learned that from him that politics was local, and that knowing and understanding the views and the area that somebody represented was very, very important. Because ultimately, people in Washington care about what happens in their local communities. And when I became chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I tried to take that idea with me. And whenever I could, I would visit nuclear power plants and get to know the people around those plants. Well, after working for Ed Markey for a short period of time, I then got a job working for Harry Reid, as I mentioned in the prologue. And he wanted to hire a physicist because he was fighting an issue in his home state called Yucca Mountain. And Yucca Mountain was a place that people were planning to take all of the fuel that comes from a nuclear reactor and putting it there in a repository. So to get on the commission, Senator Reid ultimately had to fight through a process known as confirmation and appointment. So the commission is a body that regulates the nuclear nuclear industry, and it's made up of a 5-member commission. That all those 5 members on that commission are appointed by the president and ultimately confirmed by the Senate. Well, for me, this was a very drawn out and long process. When I was originally nominated to be a commissioner on the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it took about 2 years until I was finally confirmed. And it was a very long process, and there was a lot of opposition to my being on the commission because I had worked for these two people, Ed Markey and Harry Reid. Ed Markey had developed a strong program around nuclear safety, and he introduced me to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and taught me how to write them letters on his behalf, asking them questions about how they did their job. And of course, working for Senator Reid, I learned a lot about Yucca Mountain. And so I became somebody who was joining the commission, working for people who had views that typically were not represented on the commission. So it was a bit of a long process to get there. But after a period of negotiation and hard work by Senator Reid, I ultimately got on the commission. And it came down to a last-minute negotiation that he did with, at that time, President George Bush to go around the Senate and get me actually put on the commission through a special maneuver known as a recess appointment. And the reason he did that was that there was some opposition within the Senate to my getting on the commission. And in a last-ditch effort to eliminate that opposition, he had me sit down with a senator from New Mexico by the name of Pete Domenici. Pete Domenici had become known in the nuclear world as Saint Pete because he was such a strong advocate for nuclear power. And he was the last holdout, really, to me getting on to the commission. And so Senator Reid set up a meeting with me and Senator Domenici to try and overcome that last hurdle. And in typical Senator Reid fashion, he tried to make it very personal, and he told Senator Domenici that I was going to be getting married to one of his best friend's daughters. Well, that was not actually true. I was in fact dating a woman at that time who happened to be the daughter of the assistant of one of his best friends in Las Vegas. So it was close to being true. We did eventually get married, so there's a good happy ending to that story. But thankfully, one of Senator Reid's staff told me, oh, by the way, this is what Senator Reid said about you and Leanne, your future wife, so just so you know, in case Senator Domenici asks about it. Well, needless to say, I went into the meeting with Senator Domenici. He gave me a really strong sense of why he was opposing my nomination to the commission. And he told me, quite frankly, I've spent a lot of years working to make sure that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is there to preserve and protect the nuclear power industry. And the last thing that I want is somebody who's going to go there and espouse views that may be critical of the industry and have a voice on the commission that could challenge some of these things. And in fact, he never raised his objection to my being on the commission. He did ask me about the marriage, and luckily I was prepared for that one, but he didn't change his views. So Senator Reid used a special maneuver, got around that confirmation, and ultimately got me on the commission. So I spent about four and a half years working on the commission, focusing on nuclear safety, being one of the 5 members of this body. And there were a number of important issues that came up while I was on the commission, a number of important issues that I championed, but I was just one voice among 5. And so while the industry was never thrilled that I was there, at the end of the day, they weren't too concerned. But as the election began to heat up around 2008, it was possible at that time that a then-senator from Illinois named Barack Obama could actually become president in the United States. And the way that the commission works is that typically you have about 3 members from one political party and 2 members from the other. And it's up to the president to decide which of those 5 people gets to be the chairman. And when you're the chairman, you have a lot more authority than you do as just a commissioner. Well, when President Obama was running for office, he became very interested in nuclear power. And one of the reasons he became very interested in nuclear power was that in order to get the nomination, he had to go to the state of Nevada. And Senator Reid had done a lot of work to make sure that the state of Nevada became a prominent state in the caucus process, in the nomination process for presidential appointees. So President Obama, or then Senator Obama, became very versed in issues related to nuclear power because, of course, Yucca Mountain was destined to be built in Nevada. So over time, he eventually became president, as you all know, and over time, the commission changed a little bit. And when he became president, there were three Republicans on the commission, three Republican commissioners, and one Democrat. In case you haven't guessed, I was the one Democrat on the commission at that time. So most tradition, most practice would say that the president would choose, because the president was a Democrat, would choose the one Democrat on the commission to be the chairman. So all the stars were lining up at that point for me to be chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Well, in spring of 2009, after Senator Reid gently reminded the president of that fact, I finally was told that I would be chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The only thing I had to do first was sit down with the president's then chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. And I thought I would read for you a passage from my book about that interaction. And I will edit some of the language for those of you who may be familiar with Mr. Emanuel. To the U.S. Marines guarding the outer door of the White House and the receptionist controlling the inner corridors, I must have looked like every other young, ambitious person excited at the prospect of making a difference. I was led to the office of Jim Messina, one of Rahm's deputies and a former Hill staffer like myself. Jim was seated behind his desk. His eyes were narrow, as if he were squinting, and he seemed determined to let me know that I should not underestimate him, and I certainly didn't. I started to sense that this meeting was not going to be the friendly welcome I was expecting. Something surprising was going to happen. I just couldn't figure out what. I sat across from Jim, my excitement at the opportunity to demonstrate I was ready for the challenge of leading the NRC, causing me to ramble on about arcane nuclear safety statistics. Jim spoke a bit about the president's priorities around healthcare and that thing I talked about at the beginning, and climate change, as we continued to wait for Rahm. Suddenly, Rahm appeared. When I stood to shake his hand, he looked me in the eye, then sat in a small chair against the wall, his body so tense it was as if he might jump up at any moment and bolt from the room. And as he was seated to my right, I was in the uncomfortable position of sitting sideways to him. I could either look at him and ignore Jim, or look at Jim and disrespect Rahm. It was clear Rahm knew what he was doing in picking that seat, taking every opportunity to make me feel ill at ease. I decided I'd look straight at him. For the next few minutes, my gaze never left his face. And here's where I'll censor just a few words. You are an effing a-hole, and nobody likes you, he declared. If we make you chairman, everyone at the NRC is going to quit. No one wants you to be there. I'm only telling you what no one else will tell you. This was not the opening I anticipated. And all I could think was, I guess I won't be telling my parents about this meeting. Well, sure enough, I did actually get the job. And as my shock over the ferocity of Rahm's tirade lessened, I realized that I had actually gotten the job, and I would be the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So this was in 2009. And at that time, there were a number of issues, important nuclear safety issues in front of the commission. I had already spent about 4.5 years regulating as a commissioner, so I knew the agency well. I knew the people, I knew the issues, I knew the law, and I knew the regulations. And made a point of really trying to do that, because that was my greatest tool, was knowing the agency, knowing the facts, knowing the science, and knowing the law. That's how I thought I could be effective. But clearly, this was not going to be an easy job. The nuclear industry is a very, very powerful industry. It ultimately produces about 20% of the nation's electricity, and many of you who have 401ks and IRAs probably have investments in nuclear power companies or utilities. These are very good, stable investments. There are companies and industries that typically provide a lot of good return on investments. They are industries and companies that are typically recession-proof. Because even when the economy turns down a little bit, people still use electricity, they still need their power, they still generate energy. So these were not companies that were to be trifled with. And as my time on the commission went on, I began to realize how influential and powerful these industries were. Now, much of this would not have been as significant if certain things hadn't happened during my time as chairman. There were a number of important issues, as I said. One of the most important was the fact that these power companies felt that they were on the verge of a new nuclear power, what they called renaissance. So nuclear power, which had not really changed much over 20, 30 years, we had about 20% of the nation's electricity, and that is the way it had been for decades. Well, the industry was on the verge of potentially trying to build a number of new plants. So here I was, the chairman of this industry, or the chairman of this agency that regulated the industry and ultimately was responsible for licensing those new plants. And people weren't quite sure what to make of me. They didn't know what my views were about nuclear power. They knew I had worked for Ed Markey, that I knew had worked for Harry Reid. They knew I could be very critical about safety. But they weren't quite sure what I was going to do with this new reactor licensing process. And the expectations, for the most part, is that the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was generally supportive of nuclear power. And to this day, I still get people coming to me and saying, it's so strange that you were chairman of this agency when it's clear now that you had views against the industry. And as I'll show you, those views really didn't materialize until much later. But the expectation in the view was that as the chairman, you were someone who ultimately, despite the fact that your primary job was regulation of safety, would be supportive and helpful to the industry. So for many years, for 2 years in fact, I dealt with a lot of different things dealing with nuclear safety, tried to do a good job of focusing on safety and looking at these accident scenarios and all the things that could go wrong and making good decisions and trying to get support from my fellow commissioners to make the right policies. But all of that was, in a way, like almost playing Monopoly and dealing with Monopoly money, because the accidents were just things that we looked at from computer programs and textbooks. They weren't at that point real. And all of that changed in 2011, when these hypothetical accidents became very real. And it started with an earthquake off the coast of Japan near a place called Fukushima. And I'm going to read to you some of what happened. And this is in March of 2011. Deep under the ocean off the coast of Japan, two of the plates that make up the surface of the earth were grinding and pressing against each other, like sumo wrestlers locked in a tussle. Unknown to the operators at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant 100 miles away, one of these plates let go of its grip. As one piece of the Earth's crust slid over the top of the other, seismic monitors at stations across the globe came to life, their electronic needles bouncing up and down, tracing out the pattern of a gigantic magnitude 9 earthquake. It was the largest ever recorded in Japan, and one of the largest ever recorded in the world. Yet it was not the worst problem about to crash down on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear station. The upheaval of the ocean floor that caused the earthquake also sent walls of water nearly 50 feet high hurtling toward the beach outside the Fukushima plant. The tsunami lifted large boats and carried them miles inland. It swept away homes and businesses and people, leaving behind nothing but fields. Tens of thousands were killed. And despite the tsunami's thunderous arrival, the nuclear accident would progress slowly and silently over the days after the waves battered the fortified shell around the reactor at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. The nuclear reactors would be disabled from the inside like a body affected by a small but swiftly growing tumor. By the time disaster had run its course, over 100,000 people had been forced from their homes. Many of them will never be able to return. The Japanese economy collapsed, and the government eventually halted operations at all of the nearly 60 nuclear reactors in Japan. So, what I had been dealing with up until that point were hypotheticals. Now, I was dealing with something real. And while this accident was in Japan, it was something that was going to play a very prominent role in my life and in the life of the agency that I regulated. You know, whenever I get asked about the accident, the first thing people always want to know is when did you hear about it? How did you learn about it? How did you learn about things? And I have to say, I can't remember quite that well, because when it started, it didn't really seem all that significant. I got a phone call sometime in the morning on Friday, March 11th, from the people at the NRC whose job it was to alert me about things that were happening in the world. We had a group of people, they were called Heroes and Whos, kind of a acronym that we used at the NRC for operators that were standing by all the time to get information and alert people in the agency when things were going wrong. Well, they called me to tell me that there had been an earthquake and a tsunami warning issued for the Pacific Ocean. And the reason that mattered for me was that we have nuclear power plants on the west coast of the United States. So we had been trained after the previous tsunamis to have a system in place to alert our plants when there was a threat of a tsunami. So while this accident happened very near to the coast of Japan, our immediate concerns and thoughts were about the plants on the west coast of the United States, because that tsunami wave could propagate across the entire Pacific Ocean and potentially affect those plants. So that's why I was called and alerted to what was going on, not because we had a sense at that point that something was going to happen at these reactors in Japan. The tsunami wave did in fact come to the west coast. It was not very large. It wasn't too much bigger than kind of an abnormally high tide, and it didn't really change the effect of the plants or change much in the way that the plants operated there. So that was the initial reaction, and that was Friday, March 11th, the same time the accident happened, but in Japan time, so about 12 hours earlier, and the tsunami and the earthquake started. As the day wore on, that very first day, things began to change. I would start to get briefings about the situation in Japan, that there was this large tsunami, and there we're beginning to get information that the nuclear power plants in Japan could also be impacted, both because of the earthquake and then potentially because of the tsunami. And by the end of the day, on Friday, March 11th, it was clear that things were getting dramatically worse. I was about to leave to go home for the weekend, and I stopped into our emergency operations center just to check in to see if they had any news. And I didn't leave for about 6 or 7 hours, because we slowly were getting information that the plants were really getting in very bad shape in Japan. And in fact, at that time, we didn't know and understand exactly how bad things were, but we were just beginning to get trickles of information. And in fact, the U.S. government was beginning to mobilize a response. And this shows you how quickly things moved. They asked us if we wanted to send somebody on a plane that was going to Japan that would involve U.S. officials who were helping both with humanitarian assistance and military assistance and any other type of assistance we could offer. But they thought, we're starting to hear information about this nuclear situation. Do you want to send somebody? And we had to act quickly. So I was in our emergency operations center. I looked around the room and I said, does anybody know anything about these reactors that are in Japan, and can they go to Japan? Well, I had one individual stood up and said, I can go. And he said, great, can you get to the airport in about an hour? He said, sure. And he said, and I can stop by my house on the way and grab my passport. So as typical NRC fashion, people were always prepared and thinking ahead. So that individual got on a plane and flew to Japan, and over the next 48 hours or so over the weekend, the situation deteriorated dramatically. And the whole world watched as this reactor began to go through very significant changes and problems. And one of those dramatic events was a massive explosion. And that explosion came from the combustion of hydrogen. So prior to this accident, when many people think about the dangerous, damaging effects of hydrogen, you may think about the Hindenburg. The Hindenburg was an airship that was fueled with hydrogen. And due to a still not completely explained reason, that airship blew up and it exploded in a massive ball of fire. Well, the same kind of thing was happening now at these power plants in Fukushima. And when these accidents happened and these hydrogen explosions happened, they spilled nuclear material and radioactive material all around this reactor site. So not only was radiation leaking from the reactors themselves by this point, but this explosion caused severe damage to the site itself. And it made it much, much harder for the workers who had to go in and try and recover and restore these reactors. It made it much more difficult for them to do their jobs. And just to put this in perspective for you, this is all because of a technology that is just supposed to generate electricity. And here it was releasing tremendous amounts of very, very harmful radiation, not only into the atmosphere, leading to the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of people, but putting the workers whose job it was to try and protect it at the risk of very severe radiation exposure. This accident was largely out of control, and it was out of control by that point in a way that could not be recovered. Now, this was an accident in Japan, but because of the strong and close relationship between the United States and the Japanese government, we played a strong role in dealing with and responding to this accident, and also because this technology was ultimately U.S. technology. So the world was looking to us and then to me as the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to say something. Well, over the weekend, as we were getting information, we continued to believe, and I believe, that the right approach was to let the Japanese officials talk, that it was an accident happening there. They knew more about what was going on than we did, and we needed to defer to them. By Monday, things had changed, and people felt very strongly that we needed to say something. So I gave the first public statements that I made about the accident on Monday, March 14th. And I want to read from you just a few of those comments. And these words are important because it'll show you how rapidly evolving this accident was. So I gave this public statement at the White House in the briefing room, in front of a room a little bit smaller than this, filled with reporters, which at the time didn't seem all that significant because I didn't realize until after that, in fact, that statement that I was giving was broadcast live across pretty much the entire world. Upon arriving at the White House, I had a lengthy discussion with Jay Carney, the President's press secretary, and Dan Poneman, Deputy Secretary at the Department of Energy, about what each of us would say. We then entered the White House press briefing room. I had several basic messages to deliver, honed through extensive NRC briefings over the previous days as I learned everything I could about the accident and its implications for plants in the U.S. Then I stood behind the White House podium with Poneman and Carney and relayed that the Japanese government, and relayed these messages to the press. First and foremost, I asserted that the Japanese government was in the best position to instruct Americans on how to act because it should have the most accurate, up-to-date information. Keep in mind that there's a large number of Americans who live in Japan, as well as military officials and their families. So we have a very strong presence there, and that became a very important focus of what we were trying to do, was figuring out what do we do and tell those Americans in Japan. Second, based on my understanding of the nature of the accident, I declared that even in a worst-case scenario, radiation from Japan could not be concentrated enough to pose a hazard to Americans outside of Japan, not even to those living in Alaska and Hawaii, after traveling thousands of miles across the ocean. Third, I offered assurances that American plants were different from those in Japan. Those assurances to the media and TV viewers watching were, it turned out, platitudes. After several months, as I struggled to push through reforms based on the lessons of Fukushima, I would come to realize that American plants were not so different after all. It would take only a matter of hours before I began to doubt my first point as well. By Monday evening, just hours after I told the world to listen to the Japanese government, I told the government to trust our agency experts instead. And they were saying something very different than what the Japanese government was saying about how this accident would progress. So things were moving very rapidly. And in the course of just 2 or 3 days, we would go from saying that the U.S. government should listen and American people should listen to what was happening in Japan, to giving them our own advice about what we should do. And that advice came from all the experts at the NRC who are now working around the clock in our operations center to understand what was happening, to try and get information out of their colleagues in Japan. But unfortunately, one of the things that happened in Japan was that they lost all their instrumentation about the reactors. And in fact, the people who were working in the control rooms that controlled how these big giant machines operated, they were working in the dark. They quite literally lost all power, all their instrumentation, and you can imagine banks of little lights and buttons and all kinds of things were dark. And the lights in the rooms themselves went dark. So these workers who were struggling to try and understand what was going on with these reactors were operating under tremendous stress and almost impossible conditions. And in fact, what was happening was at that point largely in the control of physics. There was very little that people could do anymore to stem the tide of this catastrophe. So one of the things that we wound up doing was advising Americans that they should stay about 50 miles away from this power plant. And that was very different from what the Japanese was advising their citizens. So let me just read to you a passage about that. The crisis slowed for a day, and I even managed a few hours of sleep that night in my house. But when my cell phone rang early Wednesday morning, I was patched into a conference call with several senior officials from the NRC and the Naval Reactor Program, which is responsible for the design, development, and safety of nuclear reactors on military ships. None of these individuals were easily flustered or prone to overreaction, but they were unanimous. The situation in Japan had worsened yet again. The performance of the reactors continued to degrade, and the U.S. government had received reports that people in the Japanese utility company TEPCO and in some parts of the Japanese government believed the situation was beyond control. Preliminary reports indicated that TEPCO was advising staff to abandon the reactor site. We began to formulate a concise message for emergency response officials in the White House, having agreed on the needed actions. We had to get Japanese officials to bolster the personnel on site, even if that meant placing people in potentially life-threatening situations. And we had to reinstate the recommendation that Americans stay more than 50 miles from the reactor. So this was an almost heard of action, where you had one country turning to another country and publicly saying you're not doing enough to protect your people. And we felt strongly that we were making the right decision, and that's in fact exactly what we did. So this was one of a number of incidents that happened as this accident progressed, and I ultimately came head on with the nuclear power industry because the statements about 50 miles were very different than what we tell people here in the United States. In the United States, we only require people or plants to have plans in place to evacuate people about 10 miles from the reactor. So the things we were seeing at this plant were very different from these hypothetical scenarios we had always planned and prepared for in the United States. And it's at that point that my sense and understanding of this technology began to change. So over the next 6 months, I spent a lot of time and effort trying to deal with not only the accident and the aftermath in Japan, but how we would respond here in the United States. And I'll leave much of that for you to read in the book. But I do want to leave you with one sentence about where that left me. I wound up in front of a congressional hearing at one point, and in front of a congressman from South Carolina by the name of Trey Gowdy, and he said to me, "What do we call people who do the kinds of things that you do?" And in that hearing, I thought, well, you know, maybe a bad person, but his answer was an inmate. So I had gone from being the person who was in charge of this response and being the public face in many ways for the administration and the U.S. government in dealing with this reactor to someone sitting in front of a congressional hearing being accused of something that could land me in jail. Well, needless to say, I did not land in jail. So a lot happened, and what I want to close with is just telling you how the industry responded. And you remember at the beginning, I talked about the two most important issues for the president as relayed to me when I started, healthcare and climate change. And as I started with that quote you see in front of you, many people still believe that the solution to climate change was nuclear power. And when I started as the chairman, the biggest issue that I expected to confront was the potential licensing of new reactors. And while I was dramatically rethinking nuclear power as a technology, the industry had not really changed its views. So while I was trying to enact reforms for how we make nuclear power plants safer, the industry and its proponents in Congress were focused singularly on making sure that that process of licensing new reactors got complete. And in fact, it got to the point where after this congressional hearing where I was potentially accused of being a future inmate, the nuclear industry was so intent on moving forward that we in fact were on the verge of licensing new reactors for the first time in decades. So at a time when the industry should have been taking a pause, in my view, we were moving forward. And in one of the last decisions that I made as chairman, I had to decide how I was going to deal with that. And I want to read from you a passage from the book. With all the controversy surrounding my actions over the previous months, I was not looking forward to stepping back into the spotlight by dissenting from my colleagues on the commission. So in front of us, we had to make a decision about whether or not to license the first nuclear reactors in decades in this country. And I knew one no vote from me wouldn't do much. Licenses could be approved by a simple majority, but I thought, what else could I do? It was my staff who ultimately convinced me, throwing back at me words I often said to them. If we won't do this, then who will? If I would not say that we cannot license new reactors without acknowledging the Fukushima accident happened, who would? So weeks later, in February of 2012, when the commission formally voted on the new reactor license for the Georgia plant, I led the meeting as chairman, cast my vote in opposition, and gave the simplest explanation I have ever offered for a dissenting vote. There are significant safety enhancements that have already been recommended as a result of learning the lessons from Fukushima, and there's still more work ahead of us. Knowing this, I cannot support issuing this license as if Fukushima had never happened. But without this license condition, in my view, and it was a license condition to make these plants change how they operated, this is what we are doing. So as ever, the money, power, and promise of a new generation of nuclear reactors were too enticing for common sense to prevail. And with about a year to go in my term as chairman, I began to ponder my future outside the agency. Ultimately, I wound up leaving earlier than I anticipated in July of 2012, and that was largely because of the work that I had done and largely because of politics of nuclear power. So the reason I tell you these stories is because I started out talking about the reason that nuclear power is relevant today. And it is primarily relevant because of climate change. Because of statements like this, that nuclear will make a difference between the world missing crucial climate targets or achieving them. Or statements like this, nuclear is ideal for dealing with climate change because it is the only carbon-free, scalable energy source that's available 24 hours a day. So when I was chairman, the industry was on the verge of licensing tens of new reactors. And they had to start with a couple. And they promised that they would build those reactors on time and on budget. And the entire Fukushima incident aside, they were sure that they could do that. So whether you think that an accident like Fukushima could happen here, whether you think that that's a reason not to believe in nuclear power or whether to believe in it, the truth is that nuclear power is too expensive. And I want to close with a few more slides. Of the four reactors that were licensed when I was chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, two have been canceled. The remaining two are costing, at a minimum, $27 billion. That's for two nuclear reactors. That's the equivalent of about, it's a lot of solar and wind. It's almost 10 times more solar and wind power that you could do with that amount of money and get the equivalent in carbon-free electricity. So nuclear power is not cheap. And these plants are years behind schedule. They are, as you can see, tens of billions of dollars over budget. So when I see and hear people talk about the nuclear power industry, what I know and understand is an industry that, when you're dealing with an incident like Fukushima, the most important pressing need wasn't to make reforms, but it was to get a new generation of reactors built. And we got those licensed over my objection at the NRC. And today, they're wildly over budget, wildly behind schedule, and nowhere close to being a solution to climate change. The good news, well, if you look, this is another slide that just tells us these are all the other reactors. And over time, they're also going to go away. And it's a large number of nuclear power plants. So nuclear is not a growing technology. And the plants that were supposed to usher in a new age of a nuclear renaissance here are a failure. But the good news, and this is an analysis done by a very prominent energy analysis, financial analysis firm. It's a little bit complicated, but I promised you at least one chart as a scientist. To the left is better than to the right. And what this tells you is the relative cost of different types of energy sources. And if you look at the top one half, What you see there are the traditional kinds of clean energy sources, the things that we need in order to really deal with climate change. And you can see that all of those are closer to the left. And in fact, the cheapest way that we can generate electricity today is actually with wind power. And that's wind power that doesn't have any subsidies. If you add in some of the few remaining subsidies, it gets even cheaper. And you can see on there the third or fourth line, the next cheapest really is solar power. If you look down at the bottom, the second from the top of that section at the bottom is nuclear power. And you can see the line as well to the right. So the future and the solutions for our environment are also the same solutions for our pocketbook. And it turns out that the real solutions and the right way to deal with climate change is through these kinds of technologies. And for a lot of the reasons hopefully I've talked to you about tonight, you can see that nuclear power is not the best solution for a number of reasons. So with that, I appreciate your attention and look forward to answering any questions that you may have. Thank you.
As you probably know, about 2 hours west of here, there's a nuclear reactor pair. The other pair, almost exactly 40 years ago, had a little problem where the pressure release valve stuck open. Shouldn't have been a big deal, caused a partial meltdown due to some problems that had happened. Make a long story short, this year or so, they're supposed to shut the other plant down. But to have Pennsylvania meet its clean energy targets, they really need that plant to stay open as safely as possible, and not for any longer than possible, but not to shut it down prematurely. Is there anything we can learn? Say, I haven't worked in this industry in a while, but basically, if it's a GE Mark I type reactor, is there something they can do to that plant to keep it running as reliably and safely as possible until they can transition to something else? And there's what you say, lessons learned that they need to do for new plants or for Japanese plants. How much has been done or needs to be done or could be done to implement lessons learned for all the plants? I think there's at least 31 reactors in America that have the same GE Mark I design, and one solution would be to shut them down as quickly as possible, but the ones that are running that we need to run, what can we do to keep things running safely and reliably?
Well, let's start right there. So the question was largely about the Three Mile Island plant, which I do talk about in the book and the accident that happened at Three Mile Island, which was one of the first accidents with nuclear technology in the world, the significant accidents. And these plants are in a very unique environment. They operate here in Pennsylvania and other states in this region called PJM, which is a competitive electricity market. And in that market, nuclear power plants are having trouble surviving because they are actually, as you see on this chart, some of the more expensive ways to generate electricity. So the newer sources that they're competing against is largely cheaper solar and wind, some degree of gas, but primarily it's the solar and the wind. So those plants are on the verge of shutting down because they can't compete with the cleaner alternatives. And so, to my view, the best way you deal with this situation is ultimately you let the market work. So this is a unique moment kind of in environmental history where the market solution is really the right environmental solution for a lot of different reasons. And that's why these plants are on the verge, and the power companies are trying actually to get subsidies right now to keep them operating. And when I say subsidies, ultimately the only way you can subsidize them is to make electricity more expensive so they can compete with the cheaper alternatives. So either everything else has to get cheaper or you just have to pay a little more for that power. At the end of the day, people, you as consumers in this state, are going to pay more for your electricity in order to keep those plants around. And, again, from a climate perspective, if there were no alternatives, we'd have to look at that, but there are alternatives. There are ways to do it otherwise. And just a second question, just to talk about the reforms. There were a number of reforms that we proposed, that the staff at the agency proposed. Most of them have largely been put to the wayside. And there's largely been one solution that the industry actually proposed, kind of as a voluntary approach to dealing with the accident. And in the years since I've left the commission, the agency has largely adopted as the solution to the Fukushima problem. And it basically involves, when you get into an accident, having additional equipment to try and mitigate the effects of the accident. In my view, you need to focus more on preventing the accidents to begin with. And that's very difficult with the technology.
I don't recall ever actually hearing the current president speak on this issue So from this position of total ignorance, what has he said? How much faith do you have in him to, I mean, I would imagine very little, given the choices he has made for heads of other departments. They always seem to be people who are completely opposite the goals of the department they're, you know, intended to run. So what can we deduce from the way Donald Trump engages with this issue? And separate matter, it would just seem to me, as a total non-scientist, that what they finally had to do with Fukushima was completely inadequate, and it just seems like a lot has not been told either the Japanese public or the world, and it sounds to me like it's just an ongoing threat. So if you can say something about that.
Sure. So the first question relating to President Trump. So the president has tried to do some things to support the nuclear power industry. It really gets back to the issue that I talked about earlier. He ordered the Secretary of Energy, Secretary Perry, to essentially create a program to subsidize nuclear reactors as well as coal plants. It was a program that was ill-conceived and not really well thought out and not really sensible. And what essentially he wanted the secretary to do was to change the rules around electricity markets in this country to subsidize operation of nuclear power plants. And in these areas in which you have competitive electricity markets, and actually the organization at the federal level that governs these competitive electricity markets, another commission known as FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they rejected those proposals because their mantra has always been that we operate in what we call a technology-neutral environment. So we let the market decide, we let the prices decide what kinds of technologies should survive. And right now, nuclear in these competitive markets is not surviving. But again, the good news is that the right kind of solutions are from a climate change perspective. So that's the one thing that the president has really done. He's not said a lot more about nuclear. He's talked more about coal than nuclear, but he has at times lumped nuclear into that kind of general category. The second question about really what's still going on at Fukushima, I do talk in the book about this, and one of the really touching moments for me was dealing with my counterpart in Japan, who also happened to be an individual who was new in his position, did not have the same, you know, similar kind of lack of seasoned, long-standing political support, and we were both thrust into this response. And in December of 2011, after the accident had gone on for about 6 months, and the reactors were in a better and more stable condition, I went back there to kind of mark that occasion. And we had an event together, and we talked about the future, and we were both about the same age. I was 39, he was 40 at the time. And we said, you know, we'll come back, hopefully in 40 years, to celebrate the final cleanup of this reactor. Because the cleanup will go on for decades. This is not going to be an easy task to fix what's happened there and really to make the situation right. So it is an ongoing situation. It's not an immediate accident anymore, but there's volumes and volumes of radioactive contaminated water that that they still need to figure out how to deal with, and that they continue to generate that water every day. So it is still a severe environmental situation there, and not the immediate crisis that it was certainly in 2011, but it has not really gone away as a problem. And let's do right here.
A two-part question. So what are the French doing that's different than what we are doing? And then the other part of the question is, as Japan has decided to switch out of nuclear, how can they switch out quickly enough to actually provide the energy that they need?
So The first question was about France. Well, France's nuclear program, they are often talked about because they are the country right now that has the largest percentage of electricity generated from nuclear power, close to 80%. But they have far fewer reactors than we do, about half the reactors we have here in the United States. They are, in fact, having problems with their reactor program. They've had a number of scandals related to problems with manufacturing equipment and falsification of records. And so, in fact, the position of the government in France right now is actually to phase down nuclear power to be about 50% of their electricity. They are actually in the process of also constructing a new power plant, which was supposed to be online even earlier than the plants in the United States. It's unclear whether that plant will actually ever get completed because one of the major safety components they built, they actually made incorrectly, and they fabricated the records to hide that fact. So right now they're trying to understand what's going to happen. So it's a country that's going through a severe rethinking of its nuclear program. And then finally, the question about Japan. You know, this is one of the reasons why I'm concerned about people talk about nuclear as a solution, because in Japan, you had a country that was on a glide path to really doing very well from a climate perspective and a carbon dioxide perspective. You then had the accident. And in fact, because of the accident, they shut down all of their reactors over time. They've restarted a few of them since then. And in fact, then they had to turn to fossil fuels, and their emissions actually went up quite significantly to some of the highest levels they'd had in a long time. So it turned out to be a very bad technology for them. And over the years, their emissions have actually come down for two primary reasons. They've done a real big program to implement energy efficiency and really demonstrated how energy efficiency can do a lot. And they've begun really a modest program to bring in renewables. So they're showing that that path can work. Unfortunately, they didn't plan it early enough so that they're in this crisis mode now, having to respond to the accident and ramp up those industries. But all indications are that it's working and they're heading in the right direction now.
I've always wondered about the vulnerability of nuclear reactors in the United States to a terrorist incident, an armed takeover, for example, leading to destruction of the reactor and discharge of radioactive material. I wonder if you could speak to that. What are the risks? What is the likelihood?
I can speak to it a little bit. This is where I get to say fun things like it's classified. I can't really tell you. The nuclear industry, probably compared to most electricity generating industry, is more prepared to deal with terrorist type incidents. Some of that is a function of the NRC being this all-encompassing regulator. And so for a very long time, the NRC has had programs in place to require physical security to protect against terrorist incidents. Certainly after September 11th, we reevaluated and rethought a lot of that programs. And there is a lot of controversy about whether the safety or the security programs are strong enough to deal with an armed intrusion. Certainly, if you have an army coming in, a plant will not be able to withstand that. But you know, a small terrorist group, you know, the hope is that the plants can deal with that and respond to that. You know, an interesting question is an aircraft impact, and that's actually one of the things before I became chairman that I really championed, was making sure that the new reactors that would be built are specifically designed to protect against an aircraft impact. And in fact, the new reactors are designed that way. But there's always a small chance that you can have an incident and you can get some type of radiation release. And that's true whether it's initiated by a terrorist incident or whether it's initiated by Mother Nature or by an operator error. And we've seen all those kinds of things really at nuclear power plants, with the exception of the terrorist incidents. But the Fukushima accident was a combination of bad design, bad siting, and obviously the earthquake and the tsunami. The Three Mile Island accident was a design errors, design flaws, and then human operator action. People making bad choices, not for ill reasons, but because they made mistakes. And the Chernobyl accident in the Soviet Union was also really an accident that revolved around poor decision-making by people. So, many different things can lead to these kinds of incidents. And, the reality is they're all unlikely, but they're all possible.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.